With so many words with double meanings and hard to remember spellings, English is considered one of the world's most difficult languages. And imagine if it's not your first language. The renowned grammar guru Minyan Fogarty, also known as Grammar Girl, writes and podcasts about grammar for the website quickanddirtytips.com. She's our guest for the hour, and we'll talk to her about the complexity of English and about learning it as a second language. We're opening up the phone lines, whether it's sentence construction or word choice. If you have a question on grammar, Minyan Fogarty has an answer. It's open phone lines with the Grammar Girl next on Midday after the news. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us for our second hour today. When you ask someone, how are you, and that person responds, I am well, is that grammatically correct? How does that sound to you? It's far more common to hear someone say, I'm good. And is that a good thing? Do you think that's a good thing in our society that everybody says, I'm good? Or when is it correct to use that versus who as a pronoun? Can you say? Or what do you think of this? I should drink less coffee, but really the problem is I should eat less donuts. What did you think? What do you think of that? How am I doing in grammar in those phrases there? All of these grammar-related questions often come up in everyday conversations, and we're lucky enough to have with us for the hour to answer your questions and mine about grammar one of the country's leading grammarians, Minyan Fogarty, a.k.a. Grammar Girl. Minyan Fogarty blogs and podcasts as Grammar Girl through the website quickanddirtytips.com. She's also an author of books about grammar, and once in a while we have her on our show here Midday in Baltimore to address some of these grammar conundrums. Minyan, welcome back to Midday.
Hi, Dan. Thank you for having me back.
Yeah, how's it going? You're still popular, I see. Thousands of people follow you. See, such a popular grammar girl.
Great. Yeah, thanks. I still enjoy my work.
Are you working on another book?
I'm not. I've just taken a job as a professor at the University of Nevada in Reno in the journalism department. So that's keeping me busy these days, combined with all my Grammar Girl activities.
Interesting. So what are you going to teach? What's the name of your course?
I'm actually teaching media entrepreneurship because besides Grammar Girl, I'm the founder of the whole Quick and Dirty Tips podcast network. So, you know, I've built an online business, and now I'm teaching students how that works.
That is great. How long has it been, Quick and Dirty Tips? How long has that been around?
A little more than 8 years, if you can believe it.
Hmm. Hey, I got to ask you this. So when you go out with friends, go out to dinner, go to a party, whatever, when you socialize, I'm sure people ask you questions when they find out who you really are. but how do you behave when you hear someone fracture the language? Do you step in and correct? Do you have a discreet way of doing that, or do you let it go most of the time?
No, never. I think it's very rude to correct other people when they haven't asked for your help. Mm-hmm. You know, if people want me to help them with their language, I will, but I would never correct a stranger in public in front of other people. I mean, I would never even do it in private. I just think it's inappropriate behavior. It's rude.
Okay. Now, what if it's a relative? What if it's a niece, a nephew, a cousin?
If it were a very young person, I might, because I would feel that I would be in a position to offer them, you know, lessons or teaching. But I mean, another adult, I really don't think it's appropriate. But, you know, my dad always used to say, I seen this or I seen that, and my mom would go nuts and she would correct him every time. So, you know, maybe between spouses it's okay, but right. I don't correct my spouse.
What we were talking about the other day in our production office about the way people pronounce words. And it's sometimes surprising to hear someone pronounce a word that you've been pronouncing a certain way your whole life. And I'm not just talking about the BBC, because you hear that all the time. But someone on my show, I can't remember who this guest was, it was within the last 10 days or so, said comparable,
mm-hmm.
a word that I've always said, you know, as comparable. And then yesterday I heard one of our producers say preferable as opposed to preferable. And I don't know. It just sort of bounces off my ear, and it makes me. I'm tempted to say, you know, where'd you go to school? Oxford or something like that, which is a way of complimenting them at the same time bringing up the issue of pronunciation.
See, I am more likely to say, oh my gosh, have I been saying that wrong my whole life?
Yeah, true.
I still occasionally mispronounce things in my podcast. It's a topic I've been meaning to cover at some point in the near future because I find this phenomenon where I will have read a word in a book many times, but I maybe have never heard someone pronounce it. And
right.
I find that I don't know how to pronounce it. So, you know, when I'm doing my podcast, I often have to go look up the pronunciation of words, and I posted something to the Grammar Girl Facebook page and found that a lot of other people have that same problem. So I'm putting together a list of words that, you know, people are likely to have read but never heard and aren't sure how to pronounce.
410-662-8780 is our phone number for Midday here in locally. Toll-free long distance, if you're following, catching up with Mignon Fogarty on our show today from anywhere in the country, 866-661-9309. And you can also send us an email, midday@wypr.org. And we're on Twitter. There's Dan Rodericks or MiddayWYPR on Twitter. And I'm going to bring up something here that I'm just learning about Twitter. I guess I should have known this by now, Mignon, but you probably see a tweet and retweet and find that, well, your retweet doesn't fit within 140 characters all the time, but you'd like it to.
Right.
So you modify or edit the original tweet.
And then you use MT instead of RT for modified tweet.
Yes, thank you very much. I just found this out today because one of our listeners noticed that we retweeted something she said on Twitter and deleted a few words to make it fit.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, just a note to use MT when retweeting someone and you change the text or modify it.
So, right.
So I learned something every day here. So, okay.
I have to do that sometimes. Someone will tweet something very clever, but it'll have some sort of error in it. And I know that if I retweet it, I'll bring the wrath of thousands upon them. So I will edit it before I retweet it.
Listen, you know, you heard me introduce the show, and I came up with the fewer and lesser example there. So why don't we go over that? Some people might be wondering, what's wrong with what Dan said? I said, I should drink less coffee, but really what the problem is, I should eat less donuts. So let's deal with that one right off the bat, Mignon.
Right. Well, the simplistic rule is that less is for things you can't count, and fewer is for things you can count. So you can't count coffee, so then that's less coffee. But you can count donuts. Maybe you ate 3 donuts. You can count those, so you should eat fewer donuts. It's actually a little more complicated than that. The Chicago Manual of Style recommends using a different rule that not as many people have heard, which is to use fewer for plural items and less for singular items.
Mm-hmm.
So coffee is singular and donuts are plural, and so that fits the same rule, but it covers some interesting exceptions that people struggle with. So people often think that one less donut is wrong because you can count one donut, but one less donut actually is the correct way to say it. And if you use that singular plural rule, then you can see that one less donut is correct. So it's sort of a broader rule that covers more situations.
Thank you very much, Mignon. Hey, back to my original question about correcting people.
Mm-hmm.
I think some people relish the opportunity to correct, but they may correct something and actually be wrong.
That happens all the time. When I first started the Grammar Girl podcast, people would write in to correct me afterward, and I would assume they were right, because who would do that?
Right, I didn't know for sure. Right.
And I quickly learned that people, you know, they don't go do the research. They don't go look things up in dictionaries or usage guides. They just rely on what they think they know and are very willing to go correct others based on, you know, some vague memory of what their second grade teacher told them. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that's another huge risk. If you go around correcting people, there's a good chance that you might not actually be right.
Well, my pet peeve, and it's not really a pet peeve anymore, it's just something that I've clung to. That I cling to. I use the present tense. I cling to,
mm-hmm.
even though times have changed. John has over $5,000 versus John has more than $5,000. Well, you know, I learned the first newspaper where I worked as a reporter that it was over referred to a physical state. Your hand is over the table. My hand is over the table. And more than referred to amounts. So when you were referring to an amount, use more than. Don't say over $5,000. And, you know, I correct people on that. I correct my producers here. I see it in my in copy at the newspaper. I go up and I say, you know, it's supposed to be more than. And then someone pulls out the Associated Press manual and says that times have changed, old Mr. Rodericks. It's AP says you can say over now.
Right. And it's not surprising that you would have learned that because it's a style rule, and it was only ever an Associated Press rule. No other book recommended doing that. But people who learned AP style had it drilled into their heads not to use over to mean more than. And I think it was last year, I was at the American Copy Editors Society meeting when the Associated Press made the announcement that they were changing their style and they were going to allow over to mean more than. And I was in this room and I could not get a cellular signal, and I was just dying because I wanted to tweet about it so much. I knew that the internet was just going to explode and I couldn't connect. And, you know, I didn't get something out about it until a couple of days later. And it was true that the internet just went, people lost their minds over this rule change. But it is bringing the AP more in line with other American usage guides.
And back to the other example I cited at the beginning, when someone says, I'm good, how are you? You ask, how are you? And someone says, I'm good, I am good. It's become so common now. Now it's a way of saying no thank you, too. And you want some more coffee? I'm good. You know, it used to be no thank you, but thanks for asking kind of thing. But anyway, Minion, where are you on that one?
Well, it's tricky because I'm good is actually grammatically correct. Good is acting as a predicate adjective in that kind of sentence. So the same way you'd say squiggly is yellow, good is acting as an adjective because it comes after a linking verb. And I'm afraid now I've just lost all your listeners, but just trust me that I'm good is actually grammatically correct because good is following a certain kind of verb. You can also say I'm well. I'm well isn't wrong. Some style guides say that well has more of a sense of your health, as in, you know, I'm well, I'm healthy, whereas I'm good conveys more of a sense of, you know, I'm having a good day, I'm in a good situation. But a lot of people think I'm good is wrong. It's one of those things that people think is wrong when it isn't. So if you say it, you're always risking that someone will think you're wrong and maybe even correct you if they're that kind of person. But in reality, if you do the research looking at grammar and usage guides, it's not incorrect. But there is a perception sometimes that it's incorrect.
410-662-8780 is our number. So, Minion, we're going to take a break and come back and take some calls. Before we do, I just want to share with you and with our listeners something that happened to me as I was preparing for the show. The Telegraph in London, the Telegraph Media Group, published a grammar quiz. And, you know, I guess maybe I'm asking for trouble taking a grammar quiz that was created by a British newspaper. But I did pretty well on it, except for this question. And I hope you saw this.
I did.
We emailed this to you. Okay. The question was, is it possible to ascertain the sex of Evelyn from the following sentence? Now, I'll read the sentence carefully with the punctuation provided. I should like to introduce you to my sister Amanda, comma, who lives in New York, comma, to my brother Mark, who doesn't, comma, and to my only other sibling, comma, Evelyn, or Evelyn. So I'll repeat that with the punctuation, and then you can think about it, folks. We'll go to the break, and then we'll hear from Minion when we get back. Is it possible to ascertain the sex of Evelyn or Evelyn from the following sentence? I should like to introduce you to my sister Amanda, comma, who lives in New York, comma, to my brother Mark, who doesn't, comma, and to my only other sibling, comma, Evelyn or Evelyn. All right, I'm going to leave that hanging there. We're going to come back and talk some more with Minion Fogarty, Grammar Girl, on Midday. See if you can figure that one out. 410-662-8780. You can find on the Facebook page the Telegraph quiz, my Facebook page, the Telegraph quiz, and that sentence if you need to actually look at it. But don't do any of this while you're driving, please. We'll be right back. And welcome back. We'll go to the phone lines in just a minute for your questions for Minion Fogarty. But before we do, I want to solve this problem here with her help. So when I got to that question on the Telegraph quiz, Minion, I was stumped. I thought it was ambiguous. I didn't think there's any way to tell Evelyn's sex from that sentence. To me, I should like to introduce you to my sister Amanda, who lives in New York. That part I understand. To my brother Mark, who doesn't, meaning he doesn't live in New York, and to my only other sibling, Evelyn, or could be Evelyn. So I was stumped by it. What do you make out of it?
So first, I have to say that it's just a bad sentence in general, because if we are unsure about what it means, like you can talk about the grammar of the sentence, but you should never write a sentence like that anyway, whether it's grammatically correct or not, because it's unclear and difficult to understand. So, you know, I'm not sure that it's important for us to, you know, figure it out. But the point that the author was trying to make in this quiz is the idea that this my brother who doesn't, that who doesn't part, you know, whether it has commas around it or not changes its meaning. So if you enclose that who doesn't in commas, then it implies that it can be left out of the sentence and it doesn't change the meaning of the sentence. That's called a non-restrictive element because it doesn't restrict the noun that comes before. If you don't put commas around it, as it's written in the quiz, that implies that it's restrictive, that it means that my brother who doesn't means that you might have another brother who does. It says that if it's not surrounded in commas, you can't sort of pick it up and take it out of the sentence without changing the meaning. So that means it's really important that it's the brother who doesn't, and that then means there's a brother who does.
So a comma after the words my brother, Mark, would mean there was only one other, only one brother.
Right.
I mean, I sort of see that.
There could be another brother.
Yeah.
There could even be another brother. Like, even if you put a comma in there, I don't think it's clear.
I don't think it's clear either. So, proving that even grammarians get it wrong sometimes, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, sometimes I'll get together with other language writers, and we'll talk about some rule that confuses us, and I can't think of what one would be right now. But at the end, we'll be like, gosh, if we can't even figure it out, what hope is there for the rest of the world, you know?
Well, thanks for going through that one with me. Yeah, commas really do count, folks. 410-662-8780. Let's go to the phone lines. Who's on line one? I'm sorry, Minion's on line one. Jim is on line two. We'll go to Jim first. Go right ahead. Hi, Jim.
Oh, hi, Dan, and hi, Minion. Thank you very much for taking my call. This is one of my favorite sections you have on the on your show, Dan. And feel free to correct my grammar, Minion.
Oh, I never would.
I have two pet peeves. Well, more than that, but I have two pet peeves that keep showing up on broadcast media. They use the words dilemma and gridlock wrong. And the news, they'll show a long line of cars in a highway, and they'll say, oh, there's gridlock on 95, whereas my understanding of the word gridlock is at an intersection where the traffic going east and west is preventing traffic going north and south from proceeding, like the shape of a grid that's locked.
Yes, I agree with that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. I'm about to send off postcards every time to the radio stations and TV news every time I hear them misuse that.
Okay. And what's your problem with dilemma or dilemma?
Well, I think of it as a choice between two unattractive alternatives, like on the horns of a dilemma, two horns.
Mm-hmm.
But people seem to use it as, I have a problem, meaning a number of things or a specific thing could be the matter. And I'm just glad I can get on the radio and say, I'm tired of people saying dilemma when they mean problem.
Okay. Thank you, Jim. I have to look up the distinction, dilemma. I see what he means, that a dilemma, you're in the middle of something, right?
Right. Yeah, I covered this in my book, 101 Troublesome Words. This is the last book I wrote, and I saved all the hard things for the end. So a dilemma, you know, that die prefix means two or double, which, you know, lends support to the idea that dilemma should be used only to describe a choice between two alternatives. And there are certain style guides that say that and do give that that restriction. But Garner's Modern American Usage, which is a style guide I really like, also notes that other uses have become ubiquitous. So
yeah.
It's sort of one of those lost causes. Like it was a rule, but using it wrong has become so ubiquitous that, you know, most people aren't going to know what you're talking about when you say, well, that's wrong.
What about gridlock? It seems to, like Jim says, commonly used, especially in traffic reports.
Right. Yeah.
But he's correct, though, isn't he?
He is correct. Yes. I actually pulled up the dictionary definition. I have it right here, and he's correct. You know, it is. You know, and it's true. When someone says gridlock, I do think of an intersection. The super interesting thing, actually, about dilemma is that many, many people were taught to spell it wrong. If you put a post out there, a lot of people think it's D-I-L-E-M-N-A, and it's actually L-E-M-M-A is how it ends. And I was one of those people who was taught wrong.
Really?
When I got older and saw it spelled, you know, the correct way in a newspaper, I'm like, well, that's not right. And, and then I went and looked it up, and I was wrong, and it was such a shock. And then I found out a lot of other people thought the same thing, and no one's really sure why we were all taught the wrong way. Maybe it was a typo in a textbook that was popular when we were kids or something.
Let's take another call for Minion Fogarty, Grammar Girl, Betty in Henderson, Maryland. Hi, Betty.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
Oh, I'm so pleased to hear Minion on the show again. It just tickles me.
Thank you.
There's a little chart up the road from me that has the little sign up front that they change with clever sayings, and the preacher always puts an apostrophe if the word ends in an S, except I haven't seen him do it with Jesus yet. We call it the Church of the Apostrophe.
Oh, boy. There's rampant use, overuse of incorrect use of apostrophes. Isn't that true, Minion?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I had a guest on my podcast a few weeks ago. One of my new favorite books is called Bad English by Amon Shea, that's how you say his name. And we talked about the history of the apostrophe, and actually people have been confused about how to use apostrophes since they appeared hundreds of years ago. I mean, there have always been ongoing usage arguments, and when they first came out, people thought the possessive apostrophe was an error, and then it was an error only when you used it on plural nouns, and, you know, it's been just in flux ever since it appeared. People were confused hundreds of years ago. They're obviously still very confused today.
Let's take, Betty, do you have one more thing you wanted to add?
I have a question, yeah. Nora Ephron was on with Diane Reinshield with her book, I Feel Bad About My Neck, and Diane Rehm said, I'm glad you didn't say badly. What is the distinction?
Right. That's another thing where people will correct other people and they'll be wrong. A few years ago, Donald Trump corrected Cyndi Lauper on The Apprentice, Celebrity Apprentice, and Donald Trump was actually wrong. So it's fine to say, I feel bad. It's actually the same reason that it's fine to say, I'm good, because feel is a linking verb the same way that am and be and is are linking verbs. And so it's fine to put an adjective after a linking verb in a sentence like that. So if you said, actually, if you say, I feel badly, the sort of pedantic argument against that is that what you're really saying in that case is that, you know, your sense of touch isn't working properly, because then you're treating feel as an action verb by putting an adverb after it. So the correct way to say it is, I feel bad. But again, a lot of people don't know that, so it's one of those tricky situations.
Here's another call. This is Terry in Baltimore. You're on with Grammar Girl. Hi.
Hey. Thanks for having her back on, Dan. This
sure.
is always one of my favorite segments. It's one of the few that I actually try and engineer time off.
Good.
Thank you.
Sure, I'm on the road for it. I had a couple of questions for you. They're both related to the Marine Corps. Of course, I'm a Marine veteran. We prefer to capitalize it. Like, whenever I write it, I use capital M. Mm-hmm. It just seemed to make more sense for me. That's not just some sort of pride thing. A Marine, the word itself has so many different meanings, unlike soldier or sailor or airman, or, you know, that it just seemed to make sense to that it would be classified that way. But I'd love to hear what you think about that. And also, ex-Marine. It's something I guess when I say we, I speak for almost every Marine out there. We don't find that is an accurate way to describe Marine veterans. Former Marine, Marine veteran, something like that. I actually write newspapers
mm-hmm.
on otherwise good articles, you know, otherwise well-written articles. I'll have a headline, ex-Marine held in Iran for 3 years, you know, mm-hmm. and I'll write them and say, I love that you're publicizing this, but please change it to former Marine.
Former Marine? I'm not sure. I've been caught up, held up on former Marine. I've been told once you're Marine,
yeah,
always a Marine. Say retired Marine.
Community as a whole, there's about 80% of the people that would just be happy if you stopped saying ex-Marine, mm-hmm. and then there's about 20% of the people who just want you to put nothing in front of it and say, you know what I mean? So those are hardcore guys, Dan, and you can say okay and nod and smile.
I think retired is okay. I think let's hear what Minion has to say about it. I've used retired instead of ex, just out of respect for those guys, but also capitalizing Marine in all cases, referring to someone who actually served in the U.S. Marine Corps.
Right. Well, first of all, you know, I totally get that, like, if you're a Marine, you're a Marine for life, right? So when you stop serving, it doesn't mean that you're no longer identify as a Marine. So I can completely see the argument that they're making there. You might even go as far as to say something like, you know, a Marine who served, you know, back in, you know, Iraq in the, you know.
Yes, be specific about the era in which they served. Yeah.
Right, and mm-hmm. I think retired Marine works really well, too, but I see why people would have a problem with ex-Marine. As for capitalizing it, I am actually not certain, and I haven't been able to find anything in the last 10 seconds or so. But, you know, what's great is the U.S. government has an online style guide. It's the U.S. Government Printing Office style guide, and if you can pull, you can usually pull that up and do a search and find what they would recommend. And I think for, you know, a branch of the military, that would be the best source to look to see how it should be handled. Although I would expect the AP style book to also have an entry on it.
Here's another call for Minion. Susan in Bel Air, Maryland. Hi.
Hello. My question is, has anything changed regarding the use of the words further and farther? It just seems like more and more people say further when, at least when I was in school, we were taught that when you're referring to distance, you use farther.
Mm-hmm.
And case in point, Ford has this huge ad campaign right now, and they finish it up by saying, go further. And every time I hear that, I think, that can't be right.
Right. Actually, I used that commercial as an example in a talk I gave last year because it was so strange. That is a distinction that I still uphold, is using farther for physical distance and further for metaphorical distance. I'm not aware of you know, usage experts who are saying, oh, it's a lost cause, you know, give it up. So as far as I know, it's a distinction that usage guides do still uphold and that I still uphold. But the Go Further campaign is really odd because if you listen to the whole advertisement, you know, in the beginning, they are talking about metaphorical things. You know, we're more green, we're more environmentally friendly, you know, things that maybe don't have anything to do with distance. And so you could say they're arguing, you know, we go further to, you know, improve the environment or whatever. But then when they get to the end, they are very specifically talking about the car and it going a distance. And so the fact that they use further at the end, you know, by the time I got to the end of the commercial, I felt like, I don't know what they even mean. So it was an odd commercial.
It makes you wonder, you know, what goes on in marketing departments and advertising agencies when it comes to the subject of this hour, grammar. with new social media, and a lot of companies have profiles on social media because they use social media.
Mm-hmm.
Are they being more careful as they should be about language on social media? Has that come up? Have you heard this discussed?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
It comes up all the time. Hmm. I was reading a book about the history of Apple a couple weeks ago, and they were talking about the Think Different campaign. And there was some guy in the room who apparently, he said, I was thinking to myself, that's grammatically incorrect, but he was too afraid to say anything.
Yeah.
So,
Think Different.
You know, sometimes people know, and then there have been other high-profile ads that there was one, I want to say it was Seagate, and they used the wrong version of your in the article, and then afterward when they were challenged on it, they tried to make some really strange argument about why they really actually did mean to use that word, but I can't believe they actually did. I think they were just trying to cover it up.
Another call here before we take our next break. Here's Arch in Baltimore. Arch, welcome.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've heard and seen a lot of otherwise intelligent people, I think, say the word that when using it in a sentence to describe people. Like they'll say, for instance, well, people that are from Italy speak Italian. And isn't it really people who are from, you know, if you're describing a person, isn't it who? And if it's like an inanimate object, is it that? Or
yeah.
Are those interchangeable?
This is super interesting because I always thought that you should use who to refer to people, and I still prefer to do that. But it turns out that it's not a hard and fast rule. People have been using that to refer to people for a long time. So you can find usage guides that say it's fine, like the American Heritage Dictionary Usage Guide, I believe, says it's perfectly fine to use that to refer to people, and you know, people have been doing it for hundreds of years. I prefer to use who, and a lot of other people, you know, feel the same way. But a few weeks ago, a few days ago, I released an article on my website that I found this 18th century grammar rule that was just so ridiculous I couldn't believe it was true, that Lindley Murray, who published an extremely popular usage guide, it sold about 15 million copies, you know, and back then the population was smaller and people didn't read as much, so that's a big deal. His book said that you shouldn't use who to refer to babies and children because they aren't rational beings, and that we reserve who to describe people who, you know, have you know, rational thoughts, and that you can reason with them. So it was just this completely outlandish rule based on the way people used to think of children, and that he went so far as to say that children and babies should be referred to as it. And I thought that was just an amazing sign of the times and how they've changed, and that these are the same people who were putting a lot of support behind other rules that modern grammarians don't really support. So these were the same people who were saying, you know, you shouldn't end a sentence with a preposition and you shouldn't split an infinitive. And those are a lot of things people have learned, but that modern grammarians say aren't real rules. And, you know, these are the same people who are saying, yeah, like children, they shouldn't be called who, they should be called it.
You must find yourself stuck in the middle a lot of times. You know, the example you just cited, ending a sentence with a preposition. You know, I stick with that. I don't want to let go of that. Are you saying there's some grammarians who don't believe that that's actually a rule?
Right. Pretty much all modern grammarians. It's you know, the Chicago Manual of Style, the AP Style book, Merriam-Webster Dictionary of English Usage, Garner's Modern American Usage. Like any credible book you check is going to say that it's fine to end a sentence with a preposition. It's the kind of thing that I will avoid when it's easy to do so, because there still are a lot of people who think it's wrong or find, you know, it stands out. And I tell people, you know, if it's redundant, don't do it. You know, it's better to say, where are you, than where are you at? But it's also completely correct and normal to say, what did you step on, instead of trying to twist your sentence and say, on what did you step? you know, I mean, I'm sure half of your audience is thinking of the Churchill quote.
Right.
Churchill, I don't think Churchill actually said it, but, you know, that is something up with which I will not put.
Right. By the way, where are you at in Baltimore? That's where are you at, hun? 410-662-8780. Usually the answer is, I have no idea. 410-662-8780 is our number. It's a short break. We'll come back and take calls. Evelyn, or Evelyn, in Dundalk. Actually, it's Evelyn. Evelyn says, I hear both and as well as used together incorrectly, as in she wore both red as well as blue. I think maybe the point is you only need to say and, right? She wore both red and blue?
Yeah, that seems right. Mm. As well as tends to imply that the thing that comes after it isn't as important.
Yeah.
Whereas and gives the two things equal weight.
Where does Grammar Girl come down on orientate to mean the verb form of orient? This is from Alan. I heard a BBC World Service newsreader say that once in the 1990s, and figured it out. I figured it must be a sign of the end of civilization. This past weekend, I was listening to a BBC World Service science program, and the host used orientate at least a half dozen times. This is my pet peeve that makes me crazy when I hear it. Thank you, Al.
Right. Well, gosh. So I covered this on my website a while ago, and orient is the verb that came first. It's older. But orientate, the competing verb, has also been around since the mid-1800s. It looks like, oh, this is interesting. I remember now. So orient is the preferred form in American English, and orientate sort of exists more strongly together with orient in British English. So in British English, you're more likely to hear both forms of the verb, and in American English, orient is the one that kind of won that battle, and it's still being fought out in Britain.
Okay. So that would explain where he heard it and why he heard it through the BBC. Sanjay is calling us. Sanjay from Frederick. Welcome to Midday. Hello.
Hi. I thought this would be neat because Mr. Roderick's opened up talking about English as a second language.
Yeah.
Both of my parents learned English as a second language, and in their native tongue, which is Tamil, a sentence can't contain more than one finite verb. And I think that that's such an aesthetically satisfying, such an intellectually satisfying rule that I've been trying to use in my own written English.
Let's hear an example, Sanjay.
So yeah. I was thinking, for example, an imperative would be, go to the kitchen and cook me an egg.
Go to the kitchen and cook me an egg.
Right, that has two finite verbs in it. And if you think about it, that doesn't make sense, because the function of the verb is it gives the sentence its time. And so what you're really saying is, having gone to the kitchen, cook me an egg. There's a sequencing there. And that sequencing is enforced in Tamil. But it's not, of course, in English.
So preferable would be, what you say you like, is I'm going to the kitchen to cook an egg.
Right, somehow, I mean, I wouldn't do that in spoken English, but I've been trying to do it in written English because there's something beautiful there, right? The function of the verb is it captures the sentence in time. It captures a moment.
Yes, and also it's a more economy of language. You're using fewer words to get across the same point, right?
Well, not in English, but yes.
But not in English, I guess.
Yeah.
In Tamil, yes, you are. Right.
It's probably the same number.
Yeah. It's
so interesting. Different languages, they have these different grammar constructions. You know, aside from the words being different, the construction of the sentences is usually different between languages, and it's fascinating. I wish I knew more foreign languages. I empathetic in that area, so it's always fascinating to hear the comparison.
Yes, and someday, maybe next time you're on the show, we should talk about English as a second language. How challenging this must be for people when you think of all the double meanings, words that spell differently, sound the same. It's a handful.
It's a very different thing. The questions I get from people who are learning English are significantly different than the kinds of questions I get from, native English speakers, and often I can't answer them. They're so difficult. It's really an entirely different field.
David in Baltimore, we'll go to you. Thanks for holding, David. You're on Midday.
So one of my long running pet peeves is the way people use hysterical in place of hilarious to describe a joke. Because when you're describing a person as being hilarious, you mean they're very funny. When you're saying they're hysterical, you mean they're having some kind of fit. Whereas saying, a joke is hysterical, strictly speaking, doesn't make any sense. Obviously, they mean hilarious, but you know, the misuse is so rampant, it just seems like it's going to probably replace the meaning. I just want to...
Right. Yeah, it's one of, I've covered that in one of my books, and it is. Most people don't know the difference. I actually, now that I've done the research, uphold the difference in my own speaking and writing. Hysterical actually comes from the root word is the word for womb, and it comes from the idea that only women have these kind of hysterical fits. And it's related to, it comes from the same root as hysterectomy. So when you're thinking of someone becoming, you're saying something is hysterical, it's sort of a derogatory remark about women having hysteria. So I always use hilarious, but yeah, most people don't know the difference now these days.
This is an email from Susan, who is a copy editor proofer. She says, I'm always confused by certain compound words used as adjectives. In this case, she's speaking of hyphenated adjectives.
Mm-hmm.
She says, I know it is correct usage to write a well-defined thing with a hyphen between well and defined, or a well-made sweater, a hyphen between well and made. But I also think the thing is well-defined, or the sweater is well-made, also makes sense because it is still specifically modifying that noun. But I see in usage manuals that it's wrong to hyphenate after the noun.
Right.
What do you think?
It's so funny. I mean, we keep coming back to that linking verb idea. But
yeah.
So it has to do, you know, if you're saying the word is well-defined is in that same position in the sentence as we were talking about before with I am good or I feel bad. When it's in that is well-defined position, it doesn't take a hyphen, but it does take a hyphen before the noun. So I have these example sentences in my head that I just use all the time to remember the difference. So my example sentence is, he needed long-term care, and that long-term is hyphenated, and the care was long-term, and in that sentence, it's not. I've just memorized those two
mm-hmm.
sentences
mm-hmm.
to use them as an example for myself.
Thank you very much, Minion. Here's Bradley with one of my favorites. Of course, I hear this all the time. And this is when sometimes I am tempted to step in and correct. Bradley says, I cringe when I hear it, but I often hear people use the pronoun I as an object when linked to another person. For example, he threw the ball to Sheila and I. Where does this misuse come from? Or should I say, from where does this misuse come? You know, Nick and me are going to the movies. Is the other side of that one.
Right. Yeah. Well, there are a couple of theories about where we get that problem. So some people say it's hypercorrection. So, you know, kids will say, Bobby and me are going to the store. And the parents will say, Bobby and I. And kids, some people think kids absorb that it is always Bobby and I, no matter where it is in the sentence.
Ah.
You know? So that's one theory. But I
overcorrection. Excuse me. I'm just laughing at that idea. Your parents overcorrected. That's why you carry this flaw around through life. Thank you, Minion. Thank you.
Sure. And then I had a guest writer a few months ago, Gretchen McCulloch, who, because of her knowledge of other languages, was talking about French pronouns and how they're very different from English pronouns, and they sort of fit more with that confusion over I and me that people have so much in English. And, you know, French had a very strong influence on the English language. You know, French was the official language in England for hundreds of years. So it also possibly could be a holdover from that French influence on English. I'm not so sure about that, but it's a super interesting theory, and I really enjoyed that,
yeah,
that article she wrote for
I
me.
I like that. I appreciate it. That's very interesting. Tina posted on Facebook just an observation about a manner of speech. She says, what do you think of the phrase, really kind of? It seems like people really kind of can't commit to really thinking something without qualifying it with kind of. I mean, yeah.
It sounds like slang. It sounds like something teenagers would say. You know, it's what I would call informal language. You know,
mm-hmm.
certainly you could hear a bunch of teenagers at the mall saying, yeah, he really kind of didn't want to ask her to the prom or something like that. But, you know, it's not the kind of thing that you would we hope, find, you know, in their homework.
Yeah, or in a job interview. Yeah. I'm really kind of sort of interested in this job. Okay, here's a question from Linda in Stuartstown, Pennsylvania. When writing, as I am now, with quotation marks, do I close quote first, then add the question mark, exclamation, period, comma, etc., or add them inside the quotes, since I'm not sure I tend to do either or?
Yeah, I get this question all the time. And the one reason people are confused is that the rule is different in American English and British English. So in America, we put the periods and commas inside the closing quotation mark.
Always.
Always.
Yes,
yeah.
Always.
The rare exception is what I tell people who are writing user manuals or technical documents where they're maybe telling people something to type into a text box. Mm-hmm. You know, they're saying, you know, type welcome. And if they have to put that in quotation marks, if they put the period inside those quotation marks, people might think they have to type the period when they shouldn't. So in that rare case, I tell people it's fine to put the period or comma outside the quotation mark. But it's better if you can use a different way to highlight the word, if you can put it in italics or bold or something like that, so there's no confusion.
Here's a question from Donna in Baltimore for Minion Fogarty, Grammar Girl. Go right ahead, Donna.
Yes, hi. First of all, I'm loving the program.
Great.
And my husband, who's his first initial language is French and then Italian, and English is his third language, and he uses the word as when I think he should be saying because. And I was wondering about your take on this.
That's interesting. I think that's something my husband does too, and he doesn't have he doesn't speak French or Italian before English. You know, people have these different ways of saying things. I think it's I'm actually not certain. I wouldn't go so far as to say it's incorrect, but it's a more unusual way of saying it. It probably is influenced by his native language, but it's something that some native English speakers do too. It could be regional. I'm not quite sure.
Hmm. I hear people do that a lot. I need you to pick me up as I won't have my car.
Right.
Right, instead of because. Hey, this falls into the category of a word that we may not be using much anymore, or probably shouldn't be using.
Uh-huh.
This is a lead paragraph from a Baltimore Sun story. Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake plans to announce a working group on Friday to study the costs and privacy concerns that would be associated with equipping Baltimore police officers with body cameras that would film their interactions with the public. Well, we don't use film anymore. This is the digital age. I would suggest striking the word film there and using the word record, that would record their interactions with the public, presumably video record, because the word camera's in that sentence. So film... You know, are you going to film this today? Unless you're really using film, you know, I'm not sure you should use the word film.
Yeah, this came up a while ago, back when Ferguson had happened, and I was writing something, and I first wrote something about shooting video,
mm-hmm.
and then I thought, oh, shoot is a horrible word to use
yeah.
in this situation, and so I changed it to film a video, and then people brought up that point that you're making, that there is no film in the camera these days, so... So, yeah, you're not the only one to have thought that.
Yeah, if you're making a movie, if you're shooting some TV shows, I think it might be shot on film. I don't know. Not very many. But film is actually used, I guess, when they make movies still. I think they still use film. I'm actually not really sure.
Minion, I bet they don't in every case.
No, it's the digital age. Minion Fogarty, great to have you back with us. Thanks for making time again.
You're welcome. Thank you, Dan.
Yeah, this is always fun. Minion Fogarty, a.k.a. Grammar Girl. You can find a link to her website or her podcast on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. You can find her on Twitter as Grammar Girl. So send her your questions if we didn't get to them today. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Hope you enjoy the program. Dan Roderick's for our staff here at Midday saying have a great afternoon. See you again tomorrow.
Midday Senior Producer is Nikki Gamer. The Associate Producer, Michael Hemowitz. Our engineers are Matt Taka and Luke Spicknell. Our interns are Connor Graham and Marjorie Goodman. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming available at WIPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WIPR, your NPR news station.